What's going on in the present affects our future, our tomorrows. Did you know that RUC provides help in preparing the tomorrows for our children? We're excited to invite you to the 15th annual RUC fundraising banquet on April 9th, where we'll present The Tomorrow Show. Our banquet will be held at the Villa Milano, with festivities beginning at 5:30, dinner is at 6:30, and the program gets underway at 7. Make your reservations today at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
Is it a miracle for infertile families or an ethical nightmare? We discuss that next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies, and today we're going to live up to our name, Principles and Policies. And we're going to talk about something we talked a little bit about last week, not as much as I wanted to, so we're going to go into it in depth this week. And what is that exactly? Well, what that is in vitro fertilization. And why is it a big deal? Well, it's a big deal because a court in Alabama rendered a court decision that essentially, at its bottom line, we're not going to go through the whole detailed, basically what the Alabama court decided. There was a case where some embryos in a fertilization clinic were destroyed by, the circumstances are frankly weird. A patient in that clinic wandered into a cryogenic holding place, cryogenic freeze. It's cryogenic embryo storage is done at a very, very, let's put it this way, it's very cold. It's done in specially designed containers. So cryogenic storage of embryos is kind of a it's a very highly specialized, if you look for in vitro fertilization and look for embryonic storage, you'll see all what it costs, which is not cheap. A lot of these places will talk about what their procedures are for security. Now, why is that an issue? That's an issue because what's happened in this Alabama case is that someone wandered into a cryogenic storage facility inside of a fertility clinic and grabbed some storage ampules of fertilized eggs. And when they did so, their hands were burned because I can tell from the papers I've been reading. I tried to do a little research on this. From the papers I've been reading, those embryos are stored at somewhere around minus 150 degrees centigrade. Now, for those of you who don't want to sit around with a calculator or go to Google or go to by the way, I'd go to DuckDuckGo. I wouldn't go to Google. But nonetheless, if you don't want to do the calculation, it's 238 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. So it's colder than anywhere else on Earth. So I can guarantee you that if you went in barehanded and touched something at minus 150 degrees centigrade, you will burn your skin. So what happened was this person somehow got into a secure embryonic facility and grabbed one of these, three containers of fertilized embryos, fertilized eggs, but embryos. In other words, living human beings stored at this temperature. I'm not talking that it's stored at a stage where they can't, there's no pain, there's no feeling, but they are human beings. not fully developed. And that's the bottom line premise. If you don't get that, that's my bottom line premise, then the discussion will not make much sense to you. We're talking about human beings. Okay, this person got burned, dropped the containers, killing, essentially rendering these embryos, these human beings, killed them. And that's the language that's being used. Dropping these embryos killed them. Okay, so how'd this person get into a cryogenic storage area where it's, you know, the room would be very, very cold. The embryos are stored in these units, these individual units that are kept colder than the surrounding room, which is very, very cold. Now, what was this person thinking? Folks, we have no clue what this person was thinking. I don't know. They were going to steal these embryos and implant them in themselves. It's hard to imagine what they were thinking. Even if you're pro-life and you thought that, these embryos should be given the best chance at life, what would be the purpose in trying to do this, unless you are so scientifically unable, so ignorant that you have no idea how any of this is done, which is entirely possible. In any case, so three of these containers of embryos, the embryos were killed, and two of the families attempted to sue the clinic for inadequate security procedures that allowed people to get into their storage facility and have this happen. And I tend to agree with that. Normally, something like that, you would have to get in through a security system, usually a striped badge and that kind of thing. Now, you could say, okay, all you have to do is steal somebody's striped badge, with the magnetic stripe on the back with your ID on it. And, if it's restricted access, you could restrict it that way. I would think that would be adequate if that's the way it was done. I don't know. In any case, the families of these fetuses attempted to sue the clinic for negligence and not having proper security procedures and that kind of thing, which killed these embryos. Well, the first judge in Alabama, the local judge, threw it out, threw the case out. And essentially said, no, these were not human beings. These were merely, it's the old argument, unviable tissue masses or simply blobs of cells and that kind of thing. And this was in 2020, by the way, when this thing happened. This whole mess with the fertilization clinic. So Alabama has a law called the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, which includes unborn children. A lot of states have laws that recognize the humanity of unborn children, although some of them try to pretend it's only a human if it's a wanted infant. It's not a human if you want to abort it. This is the kind of schizophrenia, folks, that we as Christians, most of you out there listening, I assume this is a Christian radio station and this is a Christian organization that's doing a podcast with this radio show as we record it. Most of us believe in the idea that life begins at conception. There's no other way to look at it, either scientifically or spiritually, biblically. Those are the only two ways to look at it. Life cannot begin at birth. It begins, and we discussed this last week. If you want to hear the discussion of the idea that life begins at conception, because we covered this last week, that would be the show for Today's show is for March 2nd, 2024. Last week's show would have been February 24th. That's right. I remember it was my birthday. Yeah, see what happens when you get past a certain age. Okay, so many states have this schizophrenic viewpoint of embryos. They're humans when you want them to be, and they're unviable tissue blobs when you don't want them to be, when you don't want them to be human. So, but a lot of states have these wrongful death of a minor acts, I think like around 40. So that if you do something stupid to a woman who's pregnant and you cause her to lose the baby, and remember we talked about that passage in Genesis where two men are fighting and a woman is struck and it causes her children to come out, is the way it's put. If there's no harm, in other words, the babies survive, then the father can suggest an imposed penalty, and the elders then decide, the elders who sit in the gate, the rulers, decide whether that's a just fine or not, or a just punishment. But if the baby dies, then it's lex talionis, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life, you know, that whole thing. We talked about that again last week. Okay. Mobile County Circuit Court Judge. Circuit Court's lower than the Supreme Court. Circuit District, depends on the state you're in. It's called different things, but Mobile County Circuit Court Judge Jill Parrish Phillips agreed with the argument that the clinic put forth. What the clinic claimed was that the law did not apply to embryos outside the womb. So in other words, creating another class because the embryos were not implanted yet, they were outside the womb, then the law could not cover those embryos. This is a problem if you can't see it. Let me ask you, can you see this problem? The problem is, of course, that you can't consider them living human beings if they're inside the mother, and not living human beings if they're outside the mother. Why is this a problem? The mother is the support system for the life. The life has been created. And there's the ethical rub. These embryos are human beings. I'm giving you my opinion based on both the science that I know and the spirituality, the biblical argument for life. Basically, the Circuit Court Judge Jill Parrish Phillips agreed with the argument that they're not human if they're outside the womb, and she dismissed the case. But the state Supreme Court threw that ruling out. Now, what does that mean? That means at least one of the three families, and I think two of them, appealed that decision by the circuit court judge and took it to the Supreme Court. Here's what Jay Mitchell, who was a Alabama Supreme Court justice, wrote. He said, embryos are indeed protected under the state's existing law. Here's a quote. The central question presented in these consolidated appeals, which involved the death of embryos kept in a cryogenic nursery. Boy, that is weird language, cryogenic nursery. If you think about it, cryogenic nursery, is whether the act contains an unwritten exception to that rule for extrauterine children. That is, unborn children who were located outside of a biological uterus at the time they are killed. He wrote, under existing black letter law, and we talked about this a little bit last week, but under existing black letter law, that is law not issued by a court, but passed by a legislature. The answer to that question is no. The Wrongful Death of a Minor Act applies to all unborn children, regardless of their location. Another ethical problem here. Now, I don't have a problem with that law, except for the fact that there are places in the world, for instance, Great Britain only allows the storage of a fertilized egg for about 10 years, and then they must be destroyed. Destroyed. A human being who was never given the chance to properly develop has to be destroyed. Again, you can see, do we have enough information to make an informed decision on God's view of this? I think we do. And that, I think that that passage in Genesis 21 is enough. But here's the problem. We have these abortion laws, and remember, in Ohio, we passed this horrible constitutional amendment. This horrible constitutional amendment that basically says you can kill your baby up to the point of birth. For any reason, you can begin to feel the pangs of labor. You can get to the point where the baby's head is crowned and you can have it killed. This is the law. If you voted for the passage of Issue 1 in last November, then shame on you. This is what you voted for, despite the gaslighting to the contrary. That's exactly what you voted for. What this brings up is there are pro-life activists who for years and years and years and years have been trying to get constitutional amendments passed in states that grants personhood constitutionally to unborn children. Now, what does that mean? What that means is they are protected by law. They're recognized as human beings by law, by the law of the Constitution of the state, and therefore are not subject to being murdered. And abortion is murder. We talked about this last week. I made the distinction that when a mother whose life is in danger is given treatment and every effort is made to save the mother and the baby dies, which very often, you know, can happen, then that's not an abortion. That is simply a consequence of the treatment to save the life of the mother. And I've seen too many attempts to dig up people. I used to be pro-life and then I had some problem. I just listened to one. It was a book written and I can't remember who the author was, but I did listen to a quote from this book. And the story that was told was so devoid of detail. This woman went to a Catholic hospital and you know, she had been bleeding and went there and they did everything they could to save the baby. And eventually, you know, they had to abort. No description of what the problem was. My guess is she had an ectopic pregnancy, which the hospital would have known is not survivable for the infant, or she had some other issue. She won't describe it. All she says is they almost killed her. She'd lost 40% of her blood. Well, when did she lose that? Did she lose it in the hospital? Did she lose it before she got to the hospital? What percentage of her? None of these questions are answered. And I'll be quite honest, the more I've heard this story, and I've heard it a couple times described from this person, I think that very important details are left out because she's trying to spin the events in favor of being able to abort at will. Now, do I like the idea of that some women have serious health issues with pregnancies? No, I don't care for that either. I don't like it. But it is God's will. I have relatives who chose not to have children because they were type 1 diabetics and were told and had been blind at one point due to diabetes and had had one retina reattached. They had two detached retinas that had made her blind due directly to her diabetes. And she chose to have her tubes tied in order to make sure that she didn't have any of her own children, which is very disappointing to her, obviously. She and her husband decided to adopt instead. And they did adopt. I know this young man. He's a fine young man. But that being said, there are these dilemmas. Now, at the time, she was a Roman Catholic. And the priests in the Roman Catholic Church were very unhappy that she had chosen to not have children and to do so through means of surgery. Now, she wasn't condemned for that, but they did their best to talk her out of that. You know, God might intervene and those kinds of things. So there are these ethical dilemmas that we run into. Our churches have different viewpoints on in vitro fertilization. I think you'll find that most churches, true Christian churches, I'm not talking about churches that have apostatized. There's a lot of Christian churches, unfortunately, I'm sad to say, that have apostatized, which means they're no longer Christian churches. You may think that harsh. I'd say, frankly, too bad to that. They no longer follow the tenets of God, the laws of God, the decrees of God and Christ and His Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit. They no longer are involved in being obedient to God. They are simply. Well, they've adopted a liberal viewpoint, and by liberal, I don't mean politically. I mean theologically. There's a theological liberalism. There's a great book that, if you want to know what that all means, there's a great book by a guy named J. Gresham Machen. And Machen wrote a book called Christianity and Liberalism, in which he laid out why liberalism, and by that, again, not political, theological. Liberalism is actually a different faith than the fundamental Christian faith. You can hear that phraseology, fundamentalism. Fundamentalism was considered a bad thing. Bad, bad, bad. Why? Because fundamentalism held to the fundamentals of the Bible. Now, can that get twisted? Sure, can. There are people that... hearing this will say that I'm a liberal. I'm not. I'm a conservative Presbyterian, very conservative Presbyterian. I'm in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, which liberal Presbyterians like the PCUSA and the EPC, Evangelical Presbyterian Church, would probably would consider me a fundamentalist. That's what happens to these terms. And look what's happened to this in this court decision. We have this judge, Jill Parrish Phillips, who basically just said, nope, it's not. She applied her own definition to what's alive and what isn't. What's a human and what isn't. She said if it's outside the womb, even though it is a human being and it is a separate life, it's not really a life that is worthy of protection by this wrongful death of a minor act because it's not implanted inside of a mother's womb. Okay, can you see where the issue is, where the problem is? It's when we determine, it's when we attempt to artificially define when life begins. Okay, and again, we were talking about these personhood amendments. essentially, in a story I'm reading in the UK Guardian, the United Kingdom Guardian, basically, there's a slightly disparaging tone here. Personhood amendments, or amendments that would grant fetuses and embryos the same rights as living, breathing children. Though Roe was overturned 2 years ago, anti-abortion advocates have continued to push for implementation of personhood laws. Yes, they have, and here's why. Because what has happened since the overturning of Roe v. Wade is that groups like Planned Parenthood, like George Soros' Open Society Foundation, groups who support abortion have gone through and are going state by state and passing the same kind of amendments that we passed in Ohio foolishly last November. So, what the personhood amendments are attempting to do, and frankly, folks, you ought to get involved in getting these passed. Right now, the legislature is understandably reluctant. They saw what happened during that election in November. The pro-life side got shellacked. I forget what the margin was, but it was not close, 62-38 or something like that. It really wasn't very close at all. Why? Because at the bottom line, the Ohioans are very libertarian, and other states are very libertarian on this idea. They reject the arguments that these are human beings and that they are persons, and therefore it's okay to abort them at any stage in the pregnancy. And sadly, there are people inside the church who agree with that. Very sadly. There are people inside the church that agree with that idea, that have adopted a libertarian. Now, I call myself a libertarian, but I'm a Christian libertarian, and there is a difference. My libertarianism, I am someone who believes that Christian liberty, that is, supplants the idea of legalism. It puts it away. That remember what Jesus Christ was so adamantly opposed to the Pharisees regarding was their additions to the law. They took the law and they made it into this structure that had no nuances in it or anything. They dictated the number of steps you could be away from the synagogue on a Sabbath. They dictated what you could and could not do on Sunday. My wife had a friend who was Jewish, and they would do things like tear off toilet paper, because doing that on the Sabbath would be considered working. And there were all kinds of rules that popped up having to do with how you interpret the Old Testament laws. If you remember, Jesus did many things that were supposedly in violation of the law. If you recall, they attempted to... one of the problems that he ran into was that he cured people who were lame and ill on the Sabbath. And what did Jesus say? Right to do good on the Sabbath or wrong to do good on the Sabbath? And they couldn't answer the question, so he turned around and healed this person in their sight. So they knew he had been healed. They knew this man. They knew he had been healed, but he'd done it on the Sabbath, which means that he worked on that day. That's kind of the legalism. So I'm a Christian libertarian. If you come to my church and you say, my conscience won't let me do this or that or another thing that we do, well, okay, we understand that. And there are things, it's not prescribed by the law or by the book of church order, and it's not prescribed, you know, it's a norm, but it's not a law prescribed by God, then you practice that. It's sort of like if your church has an evening service and you choose not to go to it because maybe, I don't know, you have family over, or you have other obligations. Perhaps you're required to work on a Sunday evening. Perhaps it's too far to drive to church in the morning, back home, and then back to church, and then back home. It's too far. It's, that kind of thing. That's covered by your Christian liberty, and that's why I'm a Christian libertarian. Politically, I'm a Christian libertarian. I think that the government should only step in when you can point out directly that there is a violation of God's law. We have a lot of work to do having to do with covering things like blasphemy laws and that kind of thing. Although in the past we've had blasphemy laws and we have enforced those. So we have a lot of work to do to figure that out. But that's neither here nor there. That's far afield from our discussion. I said 40 states have passed fetal homicide laws, I thought. Well, here in the article it says, yeah, 40 states. And many of them have prosecuted or attempted to prosecute women for their actions while pregnant. In other words, you've all heard of these cases where women take drugs, get drunk, do dangerous things while they're pregnant, and their infant dies or is maimed. Now, there are accidents that happen that can maim an infant, and it's really not a legal thing. It's because, well, for instance, in the 50s, there was a drug called thalidomide. And thalidomide was given to women in Europe. It was never accepted here, although women got hold of it here. But this thalidomide was designed to aid in morning sickness. It was a morning sickness drug. And some women out there will tell you flat out that the idea of getting relief during some of these morning sicknesses, some women get sick and stay sick for months, and thalidomide would be given to them, well, in Europe. Well, what happened? All of a sudden, babies were born with short limbs, short arms. Why? Well, the research... The common factor was thalidomide. Thalidomide was interrupting a part of fetal development, which, especially arms. People would be born with arms connected by a tiny little bone directly to their shoulder. And sometimes their forearm would not be there, just a hand on the end of the bone there. The bone. Humerus, I think. All these horrible things. Were women responsible for that? No. Who was? Were the doctors responsible? No. They were essentially led down the primrose path by the drug companies. And were the drug companies necessarily responsible? They were responsible ultimately, but did they know that it was going to cause these developmental anomalies? No, but they had the responsibility to know that that was going to happen. And folks, if you're one of those people that's out there that whines and cries about embryo or about animal testing of drugs, this is why it's done. So you don't end up with another thalidomide or something that indeed causes cancer. We've already had weight loss drugs in the recent past. The FDA let them through, and they let it through on the basis of the research that had been done. Well, it was incomplete research, and the weight loss drugs caused heart disease, serious heart failures, and those kinds. So people lost weight. You know, it's the old live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse. Yeah, they lost a lot of weight and then died from heart attacks. Who ultimately responsible is the person who simply wanted to lose weight and, you know, was having trouble and took a drug that was prescribed by their physician? Whose issue is that? Now, the physician is the guy who generally gets sued first. And in the case of thalidomide, physicians got sued. Well, everybody, you know, what usually happens is lawyers will sue everybody. They just sue everybody down line. Doctors would be sued for prescribing it and then, you know, wouldn't get involved in suits against the drug companies who recommended it. Because a lot of doctors don't really know how a drug operates except through the information given to them by drug company representatives. My grandfather and my uncle worked for a company in Michigan, a drug company in Michigan, for years, decades. They would go to a doctor's office, bring a new drug in, and talk about standing orders for old drugs. A lot of samples were given out and those kinds of things. So they would come in and explain to the doctor how the stuff worked. My father or my grandfather was a pharmacist. My uncle was a pharmacist, is a pharmacist. My father was a pharmacist. It was their job, really, to provide the information that the drug companies provided to them on how the drug worked, why it worked. In a lot of cases, you'll find out that here's the ugly part is in a lot of cases, the drug companies know it works, but they don't know why. The company that my uncle and grandfather worked for came up with a hair growth drug. It's called minoxidil. Any of you who are old enough to remember back to the 80s when minoxidil came out, you took this minoxidil and some, if you were bald, some of your hair would come back. Well, was that the purpose of minoxidil? No. Minoxidil originally came out as a heart drug. And one of the side effects was hair growth. Well, it turns out it was a much better hair growth drug than it was a heart drug. And it was the rep's job then to switch the doctor, you know, to go in and say, well, we developed this as a heart drug, but it works great as a hair growth drug. And they actually got FDA approval for it as a hair regrowth drug. Now, did it work super well? It did okay. It didn't give you the fine, thick hair you may have had. It kind of gave you fine baby hairs and that kind of thing. But some men were delighted when they got some of their hair back. Okay, let's go back to it. Who's responsible if, you know, things happen to the embryos because of drug company negligence, not vetting properly? Well, the drug companies are. Okay. Now, who's responsible if, a mother snorts cocaine or takes a recreational drug that harms the fetus or kills the fetus? Well, the mother is. That's recreational drug use. That is not pharmaceutical drug use. Now, are there pharmaceuticals that can harm developing fetuses? Yes, even today there are those things. That's why when you go to the doctor, if you're a female, the first thing they say is, are you pregnant or could you be pregnant? Because they're well aware that, for instance, they give you an abdominal x-ray. While a fetus is developing, you can do severe damage, and you could not damage at all. It just depends on how it's done. But that's why women are asked, are you pregnant or could you be pregnant? Because they don't want to prescribe a procedure or a drug that will harm that baby. Now, what does that go back to? That goes back to the idea that that baby is a separate human being. This is where our schizophrenia is. I'm going to go back to schizophrenia. We allow the murder of an infant up to the point of birth, just before birth. But we also say, no, the baby's a living human being who has a right to life if the mother decides to give it the right to life. Now, I would say parents, but a lot of times a man says, no, you can't kill the baby, and the mother does it anyway. Why? She doesn't want the burden of the of having this baby for whatever reason. And we this goes back as far as certain kinds of birth control. There's a question on some forms of birth control. For instance, what we call the pill, birth control pills. Some of them prevent ovulation, which means there's no egg to fertilize. Others prevent implantation. What's implantation? The egg that's fertilized works its way down the canal into the cervix and implants in the cervix after it's fertilized. But if you prevent that, then the fertilized egg is washed away. What is that? Folks, that's a form of an abortion. That's what the whole morning after pill is about. It's preventing that fertilized egg, hopefully preventing the egg from fertilizing, but if you don't, it prevents the egg from implanting. It causes your body to slough off all, the lining of the uterus so that the egg is flushed out. The fertilized egg is flushed out. So anybody that tells you Plan B is not an abortion, sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. It just depends. And you would have to capture that to know for sure. You'd have to capture that fetus and examine it. And nobody's doing that. People just run in and say, give me Plan B. Not thinking through the ethical questions and the biblical morality questions. I keep saying ethics, but I'm talking about biblical ethics, biblical morality. Basically a lot of liberals have worked through a quote unquote ethics exercise to deal with these problems. And so, well, it's completely within the realm of ethics, but is it completely within the realm of morality? Well, we don't talk about that. That's a religious, that's a faith thing. Yes, it is. It is a faith thing. Okay. Now, in 2018, Alabama voters did the opposite of what we did. They passed a ballot measure granting fetuses full personhood rights. But the measure did not note whether that applied to frozen embryos. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if they passed, again, this is from the story, and this is kind of that trying to create a false nuance here. Alabama voters passed a ballot measure granting fetuses full personhood rights, but the measure did not note whether that applies to frozen embryos. Why wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it? Are those of fetuses? And we're trying to apply too much meaning to the word fetus. All the fetus means is unborn baby in the Latin. Okay? We're trying to say that there's a legal distinction between a fetus and a frozen embryo. There isn't. They're both human beings. The fact that they haven't been implanted yet. Now, this creates a dilemma for, you know, am I out here screaming against in vitro fertilization? I am not. I understand that there are people who have fertility issues. My wife and I had a fertility issue, and that was one of the things that was on the table for us. Before we got that far, we discovered that I was the fertility issue, and I had to go have surgery and have that repaired. And once we had that repaired, then we had three children. We had three daughters. It's only lately my wife went in and discovered the physician. She went in for a procedure. They noticed a strange shadow on her when they did an exam. They noticed a strange shadow on a picture, and she went in, and they asked us if we'd had any fertility problems. And I said, yeah, we did, but it wasn't her. It was me. And they said, that's odd because my wife has two cervixes. And I'm like, you're kidding. No. It's a very rare condition. Two cervixes. And he said, the doctor who did the procedure said, this very often leads to fertility issues. And I said, yeah, we didn't have any trouble at all once my plumbing was fixed. And so we have these ethical dilemmas here. We live in an age when we have all this medical science available to us. We can fix things. People can have babies. God has made it possible for people to have babies that could not have had them, even in the 80s, the 70s, back beyond that. They simply would have been infertile. But now we have the dilemma of how it is done. We have a serious dilemma about how it's done. Why do we have this dilemma? Because the mechanical ability to do this creates other ethical dilemmas. I've been reading an article put out by Christian Life Sources that attempts to answer questions about in vitro fertilization. I think it's a pretty good article. It takes a kind of a neutral stance, although I think erring on the side of Christian morality. Hence the name, Christian Life Resources. And they ask the question, does in vitro fertilization, now if you understand how it's done, the mother is given drugs. One of the drugs that I'm familiar with is Clomid, I believe. And it causes the ovaries to kick out multiple eggs. Those eggs are collected, and it's all, remember, this is all very microscopic. Human eggs are tiny. They're microscopically sized. So these eggs are collected and placed in a proper environment, in a dish, if you will. And they are injected with the male side, a sperm. They are injected with a single sperm cell. And then there is a wait and see process. The problem is that they generally do multiple eggs at once. Why? Because the success rate is so very, very low. The success rate of this, there's a question in here that it may seem a little confusing. Here's a question. If no embryos are discarded or frozen, and remember we're talking about frozen embryos, and discarding, what ethical concerns about in vitro fertilization still confront the Christian? The answer is the most obvious concern is the low success rate for in vitro fertilization. While there is a great variety in the way IVF clinics cite statistical success, the general rule is that up to 40% of women who go into IVF centers do not get to the point of embryo transfer, that is, implanting the embryo, getting the embryo to implant, because they fail to respond to medication. There is an approximate 20% success rate for IVF based on embryo transfer. So in other words, 40% of the women don't respond to the drugs. 20% of those are the success rate. So 20% of 40% is 8%. So in other words, 8% of the women who go to a fertility clinic to have this procedure done have a successful experience. Simple math, 20% of 40% is 8%. Failure to bear a child takes an emotional toll on many couples, and it really, really, really does. And we're out here. This is why I'm trying to be so circumspect in talking about these ethical issues, because couples want to have children. And they want to have their own children. They don't necessarily want to adopt. They want their own children, if possible. Even as with a successful embryo transfer into the womb, the odds of that newborn child dying are 4 out of 5. Okay, that's 80%. 80% of 8% is 1.6%. So that means that 1.6% of the people that go to an in vitro fertilization clinic have a successful pregnancy from that. Basically, this thing basically says the odds that that new unborn child dying, 4 out of 5, are just too great for Christians to proceed. Especially if you've now got the dilemma of multiple eggs that are sitting there that are fertilized, but they're frozen. Now, how do some people get around this? Many of you will remember the debacle and the disaster that was John and Kate plus 8. If you remember, John and Kate plus 8, what was that all about? This was a couple who wanted children. They were having fertility issues. So they went to a fertilization clinic, and they, like they do in a lot of IVF clinics, there are a couple of ways of doing this. Sometimes they try to implant one egg, which is far more ethical, or they implant multiple eggs and then do what they call, to put it in clinical language, it just really should drive you insane. They try to do what they call selective reduction. What selective reduction means is abortions of all but one of the fetuses. And which ones do they pick? They just pick. It's random. If you can't see the ethical issues there in selective reduction, then we might not be speaking the same language. That being said, John and Kate plus 8, they didn't selectively reduce. They had 6. There was an older daughter, I think. It's been a while since I've seen that show, and I didn't watch it much. My wife and my kids all watched it. I didn't care for it much. It all looked too good to be true while it was going on, and then later we find out it was too good to be true, even though they still had all these kids. That was the good part. All right. The Alabama Supreme Court's ruling repeatedly references God and the sanctity of life, citing the Bible and biblical scholars, including Petrus van Maastricht, Thomas Aquinas, and John Calvin. Chief Justice Thomas Parker wrote, "Human life cannot be wrongfully destroyed without incurring the wrath of a holy God, who views the destruction of his image as an affront to himself. This is true of unborn human life, no less than it is of all other human life, that even before birth, all human beings bear the image of God, and their lives cannot be destroyed without effacing his glory." This is where liberals are going insane. You're hearing a lot of just junk that is basically said the Alabama Supreme Court outlawed in vitro fertilization. They did no such thing. What they basically have said is you cannot destroy living human beings at any stage of development. And that is that black letter law that they're talking about. But the reasoning is you can't do it ethically is because there's a living God and those bear his image at 1 cell, at 8 cell, blastocele, all through the pregnancy. This is what has the media and the President of the United States, Joe Biden, up in arms and saying lies that Alabama has outlawed IVF, in vitro fertilization. They haven't. Now, have the clinics in Alabama closed? Yes, they have. Why? Because they know now that they are in not just moral and ethical limbo, they're in legal limbo. because they have store pots of these embryos that the court has basically said, and the voters of Alabama have basically said, those are human beings. What are you going to do with those? There are efforts to adopt those embryos out. Believe it or not, there are people who attempt to adopt, and a lot of the pro-life groups know about this and have featured people who have done this. They'll adopt them. They're called snowflake babies. They're adopted, frozen embryos. They go to the clinics. They have the women agree to have themselves these embryos implanted in their uterus, and they have the baby. There are some churches, for instance, I think the Lutheran Church says that in vitro fertilization is a viable option for infertile couples if it's a husband and wife, okay, and it's their own embryos. Now, I haven't thought through this completely, but after the thought I have put into it, why? We adopt children. Why wouldn't we adopt them by giving them birth? I don't think that makes much sense, and I may be misreading the intent of the Lutheran Church. I'm pretty sure their intent would be to just make it available to husband and wives. And I don't think necessarily they would have a real squawk about someone who did the adoption at the you know, for sale stage, blastocele, whatever stage they freeze the embryos in. It's interesting that the lone dissenting judge, there was one in the Alabama Supreme Court who said no. Justice Greg Cook, the lone dissenting judge, argued that the decision should have been a legislative one, not a judicial one. Well, it already was it was made law by the people of Alabama. Here's what he says, quote, "It is not my role to judge whether ending this medical procedure is good or bad, but it doubtless will have a huge impact on many Alabamians, and it underscores the need to have the legislature, not this court, address these issues through the legislative process." He's assuming that they're bringing IVF to a halt. That's incorrect. They're bringing to a halt the idea that you can arbitrarily destroy frozen embryos. Now, this brings into question, there are other moral and ethical questions here regarding what about lesbian couples who want to have a baby by IVF? Or what about two men that purport to be married and aren't? Lesbian couples, homosexual couples, they can't be married. Marriage is defined by one man, one woman. I don't care what the state says. They're incorrect. And this is, again, the ethical questions that are involved. And I still didn't get all the way where I wanted to go. This is an important issue that Christians have to work out. And this is why we need to be involved in the political process. Because these are questions that involve the protection of human life, which is something that God has given us as a mandate. All right, you know what I think. I want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And I ask that you would join me again next week for another Principles and Policies.
What's going on in the present affects our future, our tomorrows. Did you know that RUC provides help in preparing the tomorrows for our children? We're excited to invite you to the 15th annual RUC fundraising banquet on April 9th, where we'll present The Tomorrow Show. Our banquet will be held at the Villa Milano, with festivities beginning at 5:30, dinner is at 6:30, and the program gets underway at 7. Make your reservations today at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.